placed a knee on top of his right shoulder, pinning him in place. Yarbog snorted and bucked, trying to break Roran's grip, but Roran refused to let go. He braced his feet against a rock and twisted the Urgal's head as far around as it would go, pulling so hard he would have broken the neck of any human. The grease on his palms made it difficult to hold on to Yarbog's horns. Yarbog relaxed for a moment, then pushed himself off the ground with his left arm, lifting Roran as well, and scrabbled with his legs in an effort to get them underneath his body. Roran grimaced and leaned against Yarbog's neck and shoulder. After a handful of seconds, Yarbog's left arm buckled, and he fell flat on his stomach again. Both Roran and Yarbog were panting as heavily as if they had run a race. Where they touched, the bristles on the Urgal's hide poked Roran like pieces of stiff wire. Dust coated their bodies. Thin streams of blood ran down from the scratches on Roran's side and from his aching back. Yarbog resumed kicking and flailing once he had regained his breath, flopping around in the dirt like a hooked fish. It took all of Roran's strength, but he hung on, trying to ignore the stones that cut his feet and legs. Unable to free himself by those methods, Yarbog let his limbs go limp, and then began to flex his neck again and again in an attempt to exhaust Roran's arms. They lay there, neither of them moving more than a few inches as they struggled against each other. A fly buzzed over them and landed on Roran's ankle. Oxen lowed. After nearly 10 minutes, sweat drenched Roran's face. He could not seem to get enough air into his lungs, his arms seared with agony. The stripes on his back felt as if they were about to tear asunder. His ribs throbbed where Yarbog had clawed him. Roran knew he could not continue for much longer. "Blast it!" he thought. "Won't he ever give up?" Just then, Yarbog's head quivered as a muscle in the Urgal's neck cramped. Yarbog grunted, the first sound he had made in over a minute, and in an undertone he muttered,
"Kill me, Stronghammer. I cannot best you."
Adjusting his grip on Yarbog's horns, Roran growled in an equally low tone,
"No. If you want to die, find someone else to kill you. I have fought by your rules. Now you will accept defeat according to mine. Tell everyone that you submit to me. Say you were wrong to challenge me. Do that, and I'll let you go. If not, I'll keep you here until you change your mind, no matter how long it takes."
Yarbog's head twitched under Roran's hands as the Urgal tried once more to free himself. He huffed, blowing a small cloud of dust into the air, then rumbled,
"The shame would be too great, Stronghammer. Kill me. I don't belong to your race, and I won't abide by your customs," said Roran. "If you are so worried about your honour, tell those who are curious that you were defeated by the cousin of Aragorn Shadeslayer. Surely there is no shame in that."
When several minutes had passed, and Yarbog still had not replied, Roran yanked on Yarbog's horns and growled,
"Well?"
Raising his voice so that all of the men and Urgals could hear, Yarbog said,
"Ah! Svarok, curse me! I submit. I should not have challenged you, Stronghammer. You are worthy to be chief, and I am not."
As one, the men cheered and shouted, banging the pommels of their swords on their shields. The Urgals shifted in place and said nothing. Satisfied, Roran released Yarbog's horns and rolled away from the Grey Urgal. Feeling almost as if he had endured another flogging, Roran slowly got to his feet and hobbled out of the square to where Khan was waiting. Roran winced as Khan draped a blanket over his shoulders and the fabric rubbed against his abused skin. Grinning, Khan handed him a wineskin.
"After he knocked you down, I thought for sure he would kill you. I should have learned by now to never count you out, eh, Roran?"
"Ha! That was just about the finest fight I've ever seen. You must be the only man in history to have wrestled an Urgal."
"Maybe not," Roran said between sips of wine. "But I might be the only man who has survived the experience.
He smiled as Khan laughed. Roran looked over at the Urgals, who were clustered around Yarbog, talking with him in low grunts, while two of their brethren wiped the grease and grime from Yarbog's limbs. Although the Urgals appeared subdued, they did not seem angry or resentful so far as he was able to judge, and he was confident that he would have no more trouble from them. Despite the pain of his wounds, Roran felt pleased with the outcome of the match.
"This won't be the last fight between our two races," he thought, "but as long as we can return safely to the Varden, the Urgals won't break off our alliance, at least not on account of me."
After taking one last sip, Roran stoppered the wineskin and handed it back to Khan, then shouted,
"Right! Now stop standing around yammering like sheep, and finish drawing up a list of what's in those wagons. Loftin, round up the soldiers' horses if they haven't already wandered too far away. Dajga, see to the oxen. Make haste! Thorn and Murtagh could be flying here even now. Go on, snap to! And Khan, where the blazes are my clothes?"
Genealogy. On the fourth day after leaving Farthendur, Aragorn and Saphira arrived in Ellesmere. The sun was clear and bright overhead when the first of the city's buildings, a narrow, twisting turret with glittering windows that stood between three tall pine trees and was grown out of their intermingled branches, came into view. Beyond the bark-sheathed turret, Aragorn spotted the seemingly random collection of clearings that marked the location of the sprawling city. As Saphira planed over the uneven surface of the forest, Aragorn quested with his mind for the consciousness of Gilderion the Wise, who, as the wielder of the White Flame of Vandal, had protected Ellesmere from the elves' enemies for over 2.5 millennia. Projecting his thoughts toward the city, Aragorn said in the ancient language,
"Gilderion, Elder, may we pass?"
A deep, calm voice sounded in Aragorn's mind. "You may pass, Aragorn Shadeslayer and Saphira Brightscales. So long as you keep the peace, you are welcome to stay in Ellesmere."
"Thank you, Gilderion Elder," said Saphira.
Her claws brushed the crowns of the dark needle trees, which rose over 300 feet above the ground, as she glided across the Pinewood City and headed toward the slope of inclined land on the other side of Ellesmere. Between the latticework of branches below, Aragorn caught brief glimpses of the flowing shapes of buildings made of living wood, colourful beds of blooming flowers, rippling streams, the auburn glow of a flameless lantern, and once or twice the pale flash of an elf's upturned face. Tilting her wings, Saphira soared up the slope of land until she reached the crags of Telnair, which dropped over 1,000 feet to the rolling forest at the base of the bare white cliff, and extended for a league in either direction. Then she turned right and flew north along the ridge of stone, flapping twice to maintain her speed and altitude. A grass-covered clearing appeared at the edge of the cliff. Set against the backdrop of the surrounding trees was a modest, single-story house, grown out of 4 different pines. A chuckling, gurgling stream wandered out of the mossy forest and passed underneath the roots of one of the pines, before disappearing into Duweldenvarden once again. And curled up next to the house, there lay the golden dragon, Glader, massive, glittering, his ivory teeth as thick around as Aragorn's chest, his claws like scythes, his folded wings soft as suede, his muscled tail nearly as long as all of Saphira, and the striations of his one visible eye sparkling like the rays within a star sapphire. The stump of his missing foreleg was concealed on the other side of his body. A small round table and 2 chairs had been placed in front of Glader. Oromis sat in the chair closest to him, the elf's silver hair gleaming like metal in the sunlight. Aragorn leaned forward in his saddle as Saphira reared upright, slowing herself. She descended with a jolt upon the sward of green grass and ran forward several steps, raking her wings backward before she came to a halt. His fingers clumsy from exhaustion, Aragorn loosened the slipknots that bound the straps around his legs, and then attempted to climb down Saphira's right front leg. As he lowered himself, his knees buckled, and he fell. He raised his hands to protect his face, and landed upon all fours, scraping his shin on a rock hidden within the grass. He grunted with pain, and feeling as stiff as an old man, started to push himself onto his feet. A hand entered his field of vision. Aragorn looked up and saw Oromis standing over him, a faint smile upon his timeless face. In the ancient language, Oromis said, "Welcome back to Ellesmira, Aragorn Finiarel. And you as well, Saphira Brightscales, welcome. Welcome, both of you." Aragorn took his hand and Oromis pulled him upright without apparent effort. At first Aragorn was unable to find his tongue, for he had barely spoken aloud since they had left Farthendur, and because fatigue blurred his mind. He touched the first two fingers of his right hand to his lips, and also in the ancient language said, "May good fortune rule over you, Oromis Elder." And then he twisted his hand over his sternum, in the gesture of courtesy and respect the elves used. "May the stars watch over you, Aragorn," replied Oromis. Then Aragorn repeated the ceremony with Gleda. As always, the touch of the dragon's sanguine consciousness awed and humbled Aragorn. Saphira did not greet either Oromis or Gleda. She remained where she was, her neck drooping until her nose brushed the ground, and her shoulders and haunches trembling as if with cold. Dry yellow foam encrusted the corners of her open mouth. Her barbed tongue hung limp from between her fangs. By way of explanation, Aragorn said, "We ran into a headwind the day after we left Farthendur, and—" He fell silent, as Gleda lifted his giant head and swung it across the clearing until he was looking down upon Saphira, who made no attempt to acknowledge his presence. Then Gleda breathed out upon her, fingers of flame burning within the pits of his nostrils. A sense of relief washed over Aragorn as he felt energy pour into Saphira, stilling her tremors and strengthening her limbs. The flames in Gleda's nostrils vanished with a wisp of smoke.
"I went hunting this morning," he said, his mental voice resonating throughout Aragorn's being. "You will find what is left of my kills by the tree with the white branch at the far end of the field. Eat what you want."
Silent gratitude emanated from Saphira. Dragging her limp tail across the grass, she crawled over to the tree Gleda had indicated, and then settled down and began to tear at the carcass of a deer.
"Come," said Oromis, and gestured toward the table and chairs.
On the table was a tray with bowls of fruit and nuts, half a round of cheese, a loaf of bread, a decanter of wine, and two crystal goblets. As Aragorn sat, Oromis indicated the decanter and asked, "Would you care for a drink to wash the dust from your throat?"
"Yes, please," said Aragorn. With an elegant motion, Oromis unstoppered the decanter and filled both goblets. He handed one to Aragorn, and then settled back into his chair, arranging his white tunic with long, smooth fingers. Aragorn sipped the wine. It was mellow and tasted of cherries and plums.
"Master, I—"
An upraised finger from Oromis stopped him.
"Unless it is unbearably urgent, I would wait until Saphira joins us before we discuss what has brought you here. Are you agreed?"
After a moment's hesitation, Aragorn nodded, and concentrated upon eating, savoring the flavor of the fresh fruit. Oromis seemed content to sit beside him in silence, drinking his wine and gazing out over the edge of the crags of Telnair. Behind him, Gleda watched over the proceedings like a living statue of gold. The better part of an hour passed before Saphira rose from her meal, crawled over to the stream, and lapped the water for another 10 minutes. Drops of water still clung to her jaws when she turned away from the stream, and with a sigh, sprawled next to Aragorn, her eyes heavy-lidded. She yawned, her teeth flashing, then exchanged salutations with Oromis and Gleda.
talk as you want, she said. However, do not expect me to say much. I may fall asleep at any moment. If you do, we shall wait for you to wake before we continue, said Glader. That is most kind, replied Saphira,
and her eyelids drifted even lower. More wine? Oromis asked, and lifted the decanter an inch off the table. When Eragon shook his head, Oromis replaced the decanter, then pressed the tips of his fingers together, his round fingernails like polished opals. He said, You do not need to tell me what has befallen you these past weeks, Eragon. Since Islanzadi left the forest, Arya has kept her informed of the news of the land, and every 3 days Islanzadi sends a runner from our army back to Duweldenvarden. Thus I know of your duel with Murtagh and Thorn on the Burning Plains. I know of your trip to Hellgrind, and how you punished the butcher from your village. And I know you attended the dwarves' clan meet in Farthendur and the outcome thereof. Whatever you wish to say then, you may say without fear of having to educate me about your recent doings. Eragon rolled a plump blueberry in the palm of his hand. Do you know of Elva, and what happened when I tried to free her of my curse? Yes, even that. You may not have succeeded in removing the whole of the spell from her, but you paid your debt to the child. And that is what a dragon rider is supposed to do. Fulfill his obligations, no matter how small or difficult they be.
She still feels the pain of those around her.
But now it is by her own choice, said Oromis. No longer does your magic force it upon her. You did not come here to seek my opinion concerning Elva. What is it that weighs upon your heart, Eragon? Ask what you will, and I promise I shall answer all of your questions to the best of my knowledge.
What, said Eragon, if I don't know the right questions to ask?
A twinkle appeared in Oromus's grey eyes. Ah, you begin to think like an elf. You must trust us as your mentors to teach you and Saphira those things of which you are ignorant. And you must also trust us to decide when it is appropriate to broach those subjects. For there are many elements of your training that should not be spoken of out of turn. Eragon placed the blueberry in the precise center of the tray, then in a quiet but firm voice said, It seems as if there is much you have not spoken of. For a moment the only sounds were the rustle of branches and the burble of the stream and the chatter of distant squirrels.
If you have a quarrel with us, Eragon, said Glader, then give voice to it, and do not gnaw on your anger like a dry old bone.
Saphira shifted her position, and Eragon imagined he heard a growl from her. He glanced at her, and then, fighting to control the emotions coursing through him, he asked, When I was last here, did you know who my father was? Oromis nodded once. We did.
And did you know that Murtagh was my brother?
Oromis nodded once more. We did, but...
Then why didn't you tell me?
Exclaimed Eragon, and jumped to his feet, knocking over his chair. He pounded a fist against his hip, strode several feet away, and stared at the shadows within the tangled forest. Whirling around, Eragon's anger swelled as he saw that Oromis appeared as calm as before.
Were you ever going to tell me? Did you keep the truth about my family a secret because you were afraid it would distract me from my training? Or was it that you were afraid I would become like my father?
A worse thought occurred to Eragon.
Or did you not even consider it important enough to mention? And what of Brom? Did he know? Did he choose Carverhall to hide in because of me? Because I was the son of his enemy? You can't expect me to believe it was coincidence he and I happened to be living only a few miles apart, and that Arya just happened to send Saphira's egg to me in the spine.
What Arya did was an accident, asserted Oromis. She had no knowledge of you then. Eragon gripped the pommel of his dwarf sword, every muscle in his body as hard as iron.
When Brom first saw Saphira,
I remember he said something to himself about being unsure whether this was a farce or a tragedy. At the time, I thought he was referring to the fact that a common farmer like myself had become the first new rider in over 100 years. But that's not what he meant, was it? He was wondering whether it was a farce or a tragedy that Morzan's youngest son should be the one to take up the rider's mantle. Is that why you and Brom trained me? To be nothing more than a weapon against Galbatorix, so that I may atone for the villainy of my father? Is that all I am to you? A balancing of the scales? Before Oromus could respond, Aragorn swore and said, My whole life has been a lie. Since the moment I was born, no one but Saphira has wanted me. Not my mother, not Garrow, not Aunt Marion, not even Brom. Brom showed interest in me only because of Morzan and Saphira. I have always been an inconvenience. Whatever you think of me, though, I am not my father nor my brother, and I refuse to follow in their footsteps. Placing his hands on the edge of the table, Aragorn leaned forward. I'm not about to betray the elves or the dwarves or the Varden to Galbatorix, if that's what you're worried about. I will do what I must, but from now on, you have neither my loyalty nor my trust. I will not! The ground and the air shook as Gleyder growled, his upper lip pulling back to reveal the full length of his fangs.
You have more reason to trust us than anyone else, hatchling, he said, his voice thundering in Aragorn's mind. If not for our efforts, you would be long dead.
Then, to Aragorn's surprise, Saphira said to Oromis and Gleyder,
Tell him!
And it alarmed him to feel the distress in her thoughts. Saphira? He asked, puzzled. Tell me what? She ignored him.
This arguing is without cause. Do not prolong Aragorn's discomfort any more.
One of Oromus's slanted eyebrows rose.
You know?
I know.
You know what?
Aragorn bellowed, on the verge of tearing his sword from its sheath and threatening all of them until they explained themselves. With one slim finger, Oromus pointed toward the fallen chair.
Sit.
When Aragorn remained standing, too angry and full of resentment to obey, Oromus sighed.
I understand this is difficult for you, Aragorn. But if you insist upon asking questions and then refuse to listen to the answers, frustration will be your only reward. Now please sit, so we can talk about this in a civilized manner. Glaring, Aragorn righted the chair and dropped into it.
Why? He asked. Why didn't you tell me that my father was Morzan, the first of the Forsworn?
In the first place, said Oromus, we shall be fortunate if you are anything like your father, which indeed I believe you are. And as I was about to say before you interrupted me, Murtagh is not your brother, but rather your half-brother.
The world seemed to tilt around Aragorn. The sensation of vertigo was so intense he had to grab the edge of the table to steady himself.
My half-brother? But then, who?
Oromus plucked a blackberry from a bowl, contemplated it for a moment, and then ate it.
Gleyder and I did not wish to keep this a secret from you, but we had no choice. We both promised, with the most binding of oaths, that we would never reveal to you the identity of your father or of your half-brother, nor discuss your lineage, unless you had discovered the truth on your own, or unless the identity of your relatives had placed you in danger. What transpired between you and Murtagh during the Battle of the Burning Plains satisfies enough of those requirements that we can now speak freely on this topic.
Trembling with barely restrained emotion, Aragorn said, Oromus Elder, if Murtagh is my half-brother, then who is my father?
Look into your heart, Aragorn,
said Gleyder.
You already know who he is, and you have known for a long time.
Aragorn shook his head.
I don't know. I don't know. Please.
A gout of smoke and flame jetted from Glader's nostrils as he snorted.
Is it not obvious? Your father is Brom.
Two lovers doomed. Aragorn gaped at the gold dragon.
But how?
He exclaimed. Before either Glader or Oromis could respond, Aragorn whirled towards Saphira, and with both his mind and his voice he said,
You knew? You knew? And yet you let me believe Morzan was my father this whole time? Even though I...
His chest heaving, Aragorn stuttered and trailed off, unable to speak coherently. Unbidden, memories of Brom flooded through him, washing away his other thoughts. He reconsidered the meaning of Brom's every word and expression, and in that instant, a sense of rightness settled over Aragorn. He still wanted explanations, but he did not need them in order to determine the veracity of Glader's claim, for in his bones, Aragorn felt the truth of what Glader had said. Aragorn started, as Oromis touched him on the shoulder.
Aragorn, you need to calm yourself, said the elf in a soothing tone. Remember the techniques I taught you for meditating. Control your breathing, and concentrate upon letting the tension drain out of your limbs into the ground beneath you. Yes, like that. Now again, and breathe deeply.
Aragorn's hands grew still and his heartbeat slowed as he followed Oromis's instructions. Once his thoughts had cleared, he looked at Saphira again, and in a soft voice said,
You knew?
Saphira lifted her head from the ground.
Oh, Aragorn, I wanted to tell you. It pained me to see how Murtagh's words tormented you, and yet to be unable to help you. I tried to help. I tried so many times. But like Oromis and Glader, I, too, swore in the ancient language to keep Brom's identity a secret from you, and I could not break my oath.
When did he tell you?
Aragorn asked, so agitated that he continued speaking out loud.
The day after the Urgles attacked us outside of Tirm, while you were still unconscious.
Was that also when he told you how to contact the Varden in Gilead?
Yes. Before I knew what Brom wished to say, he had me swear to never speak of this with you, unless you found out on your own. To my regret, I agreed.
Is there anything else he told you?
Demanded Aragorn, his anger rising again.
Any other secrets I ought to know? Like that Murtagh isn't my only sibling, or perhaps how to defeat Galbatorix?
During the 2 days Brom and I spent hunting the Urgles, Brom recounted the details of his life to me, so that if he died, and if ever you learned of your relation to him, his son could know what kind of a man he was, and why he had acted as he did. Also, Brom gave me a gift for you.
A gift?
A memory of him speaking to you as your father, and not as Brom the storyteller.
Before Saphira shares this memory with you, however, said Oromis,
and Aragorn realized she had allowed the elf to hear her words.
It would be best, I think, if you knew how this came to pass. Will you listen to me for a while, Aragorn?
Aragorn hesitated, unsure of what he wanted, then nodded. Lifting his crystal goblet, Oromis drank of his wine, then returned the goblet to the table and said,
As you know, both Brom and Morzan were my apprentices.
Brom, who was the younger by 3 years, held Morzan in such high esteem, he allowed Morzan to belittle him, order him about, and otherwise treat him most shamefully. In a raspy voice, Aragorn said,
It's hard to imagine Brom letting anyone order him about.
Oromis inclined his head in a quick, bird-like dip.
And yet so it was. Brom loved Morzan as a brother, despite his behavior. It was only once Morzan betrayed the riders to Galbatorix, and the Forsworn killed Saphira, Brom's dragon, that Brom realized the true nature of Morzan's character. As strong as Brom's affection for Morzan had been, it was like a candle before an inferno compared with the hatred that replaced it. Brom swore to thwart Morzan however and wherever he could, to undo his accomplishments and reduce his ambitions to bitter regrets. I cautioned Brom against a path so full of hate and violence, but he was mad with grief from the death of Saphira, and he would not listen to me. In the decades that followed, Brom's hatred never weakened, nor did he falter in his efforts to depose Galbatorix, kill the Forsworn, and above all else, to repay Morzan the hurts he had suffered. Brom was persistence embodied. His name a nightmare for the Forsworn, and a beacon of hope for those who still had the spirit to resist the Empire. Oromis looked toward the white line of the horizon, and took another draught of his wine. I am rather proud of what he achieved on his own and without the aid of his dragon. It is always heartening for a teacher to see one of his students excel, however it might be. But I digress. It so happened then that some 20 years ago, the Varden began to receive reports from their spies within the Empire about the activities of a mysterious woman, known only as the Black Hand. My mother, said Aragorn. Your mother, and Murtagh's, said Oromis. At first the Varden knew nothing about her, save that she was extremely dangerous and that she was loyal to the Empire. In time, and after a great deal of bloodshed, it became apparent that she served Morzan, and Morzan alone, and that he had come to depend upon her to carry out his will throughout the Empire. Upon learning of this, Brom set out to kill the Black Hand, and so to strike at Morzan. Since the Varden could not predict where your mother might appear next, Brom travelled to Morzan's castle and spied upon it until he was able to devise a means of infiltrating the hold. Where was Morzan's castle? Is, not was. The castle still stands. Galbatorix uses it for himself now. It is situated among the foothills of the Spine, near the northwestern shore of Leona Lake, hidden well away from the rest of the land. Aragorn said, Joe told me that Brom snuck into the castle by pretending to be one of the servants.
He did, and it was no easy task.
Morzan had impregnated his fortress with hundreds of spells designed to protect him from his enemies. He also forced everyone who served him to swear oaths of fealty, and often with their true names. However, after much experimentation, Brom managed to find a flaw in Morzan's wards that allowed him to procure a position as a gardener on his estate. And it was in that guise he first met your mother. Glancing down at his hands, Aragorn said, And then he seduced her to hurt Morzan, I suppose.
Not at all, replied Oromis. That may have been his intention to begin with, but then something happened neither he nor your mother anticipated. They fell in love. Whatever affection your mother once had for Morzan had vanished by then, expunged by his cruel treatment of her and their newborn child, Murtagh. I do not know the exact sequence of events, but at some point Brom revealed his true identity to your mother. Instead of betraying him, she began to supply the Varden with information about Galbatorix, Morzan, and the rest of the Empire.
But, said Aragorn, didn't Morzan have her swear oaths of fealty to him in the ancient language? How could she turn against him?
A smile appeared on Oromis's thin lips. She could, because Morzan allowed her somewhat more freedom than his other servants, so that she could use her own ingenuity and initiative while carrying out his orders. In his arrogance, Morzan believed that her love for him would ensure her loyalty better than any oath. Also, she was not the same woman who had bound herself to Morzan. Becoming a mother and meeting Brom altered her character to such a degree that her true name changed.
which released her from her previous commitments. If Morzan had been more careful, if, for example, he had cast a spell that would alert him if ever she failed to abide by her promises, he would have known the moment he lost control over her. But that was always a shortcoming of Morzan's. He would devise a cunning spell, but then it would fail because in his impatience he overlooked some crucial detail. Aragorn frowned. Why didn't my mother leave Morzan once she had the chance? After all she had done in Morzan's name, she felt it was her duty to help the Varden. But more importantly, she could not bring herself to abandon Murtagh to his father. Couldn't she have taken him with her? If it had been within her power, I'm sure she would have. Morzan realized that the child gave him a vast amount of control over your mother. He forced her to surrender Murtagh to a wet nurse, and only allowed her to visit him at infrequent intervals. What Morzan did not know is that during those intervals she also visited Brom. Aramis turned to watch a pair of swallows cavorting in the blue sky. In profile, his delicate, slanted features reminded Aragorn of a hawk or a sleek cat. Still gazing at the swallows, Aramis said, "Not even your mother could anticipate where Morzan would send her next, nor when she could return to his castle. Therefore Brom had to remain on Morzan's estate for extended lengths of time if he wished to see her. For nigh on 3 years Brom served as one of Morzan's gardeners. Now and then he would slip away to send a message to the Varden, or to communicate with his spies throughout the Empire. But other than that, he did not leave the castle grounds."
3 years? Wasn't he afraid that Morzan might see him and recognize him?
Aramis lowered his gaze from the heavens, returning it to Aragorn. Brom was most adept at disguising himself, and it had been many years since he and Morzan had last stood face to face.
Ah!
Aragorn twisted his goblet between his fingers, studying how the light refracted through the crystal.
Then what happened?
Then, said Aramis, one of Brom's agents in Tirm made contact with a young scholar by the name of Jode, who wished to join the Varden, and who claimed to have discovered evidence of a hitherto secret tunnel that led into the elf-built portion of the castle in Urbane. Brom rightly felt that Jode's discovery was too important to ignore, so he packed his bags, made his excuses to his fellow servants, and then departed for Tirm with all possible haste.
What of my mother?
She had left a month before, on another of Morzan's missions.
Struggling to weld a cohesive whole out of the fragmented accounts he had heard from various people, Aragorn said, So then, Brom met with Jode, and once he was convinced the tunnel was real, he arranged for one of the Varden to attempt to steal the 3 dragon eggs Galbatorix was holding in Urbane.
Aramis's face darkened. Unfortunately, for reasons that have never become entirely clear, the man they selected for the task, a certain Hefring of Furnost, succeeded in filching only 1 egg, Sephira's, from Galbatorix's treasury. And once he had possession of it, he fled from both the Varden and Galbatorix's servants. Because of his betrayal, Brom had to spend the next 7 months chasing Hefring back and forth across the land in a desperate attempt to recapture Sephira.
And during that time, my mother travelled in secret to Carverhall, where she gave birth to me 5 months later.
Aramis nodded. You were conceived just before your mother set forth upon her last mission. As a result, Brom knew nothing of her condition while he was pursuing Hefring and Sephira's egg. When Brom and Morzan finally confronted each other in Gilead, Morzan asked Brom whether he had been responsible for the disappearance of his black hand. It is understandable that Morzan would suspect Brom's involvement, since Brom had arranged the deaths of several of the Forsworn. Brom, of course, immediately concluded that something terrible had befallen your mother. He later told me it was that belief which gave him the strength and fortitude he needed to kill Morzan and his dragon. Once they were dead, Brom took Sephira's egg from Morzan's corpse
for Morzan had already located Hefring and seized the egg from him, and then Brom left the city, pausing only long enough to hide Saphira where he knew the Varden would eventually find her.
"So that's why Jode thought Brom died in Gilead," said Aragorn.
Again Oromis nodded. Stricken by fear, Brom dared not wait for his companions. Even if your mother was alive and well, Brom worried that Galbatorix would decide to make Selina his own Black Hand, and that she would never again have the chance to escape her service to the Empire. Aragorn felt tears wet his eyes.
How Brom must have loved her, to leave everyone behind as soon as he knew she was in danger.
From Gilead, Brom rode straight to Morzan's estate, stopping only to sleep. For all his speed, however, he was still too slow. When he reached the castle, he discovered that your mother had returned a fortnight prior, sick and weary from her mysterious journey. Morzan's healers tried to save her, but in spite of their efforts, she had passed into the void just hours before Brom arrived at the castle.
"He never saw her again?"
Aragorn asked, his throat tightening. "Never again." Oromis paused, and his expression softened. "Losing her was, I think, almost as difficult for Brom as losing his dragon, and it quenched much of the fire within his soul. He did not give up, though, nor did he go mad, as he had for a time when the Forsworn slew Saphira's namesake. Instead, he decided to discover the reason for your mother's death, and to punish those who were responsible if he could. He questioned Morzan's healers and forced them to describe your mother's ailments. From what they said, and also from gossip he heard among the servants on the estate, Brom guessed the truth about your mother's pregnancy. Possessed of that hope, he rode to the one place he knew to look, your mother's home in Carvajal. And there he found you in the care of your aunt and uncle. Brom did not stay in Carvajal, however. As soon as he assured himself that no one in Carvajal knew your mother had been the Black Hand, and that you were in no imminent danger, Brom returned in secret to Farthendur, where he revealed himself to Dana, who was the leader of the Varden at that time. Dana was astounded to see him, for until that moment everyone had believed that Brom had perished in Gilead. Brom convinced Dana to keep his presence a secret from all but a select few, and then... Aragorn raised a finger.
"But why? Why pretend to be dead?"
Brom wanted to live long enough to help instruct the new rider, and he knew the only way he could avoid being assassinated in retaliation for killing Morzan would be if Galbatorix believed he was already dead and buried. Also, Brom hoped to avoid attracting unwarranted attention to Carvajal. He intended to settle there in order to be close to you, as indeed he did. But he was determined that the Empire should not learn of your existence as a result. While in Farthendur, Brom helped the Varden negotiate the agreement with Queen Islanzadi over how the elves and the humans would share custody of the egg, and how the new rider would be trained, if and when the egg should hatch. Then Brom accompanied Arya as she carried the egg from Farthendur to Ellesmere. When he arrived, he told Gleyder and me what I have now told you, so that the truth about your parentage would not be forgotten if he should die. That was the last time I ever saw him. From here Brom returned to Carvajal, where he introduced himself as a bard and storyteller. What happened thereafter, you know better than I. Oromis fell silent, and for a time no one spoke. Staring at the ground, Aragorn reviewed everything Oromis had told him, and tried to sort out his feelings. At last he said,
"And Brom really is my father? Not Morzan? I mean, if my mother was Morzan's consort, then..."
He trailed off, too embarrassed to continue. "You are your father's son," Oromis said. "And your father is Brom. Of that there is no doubt."
"No doubt whatsoever?"
Oromis shook his head. "None." A sense of giddiness gripped Aragorn, and he realized he had been holding his breath.
Exhaling, he said,
I think I understand why... He paused to fill his lungs. Why Brom didn't say anything about this before I found Saphira's egg. But why didn't he tell me afterward? And why did he swear you and Saphira to such secrecy? Didn't he want to claim me as his son? Was he ashamed of me?
I cannot pretend to know the reasons for everything Brom did, Aragorn. However, of this much I am confident. Brom wanted nothing more than to name you his son and to raise you. But he dared not reveal that you were related, lest the Empire should find out and try to hurt him through you. His prudence was warranted, too. Look how Galbatorix strove to capture your cousin, so that he could use Roran to force you to surrender.
Brom could have told my uncle, Aragorn protested. Garrow wouldn't have betrayed Brom to the Empire.
Think, Aragorn. If you had been living with Brom, and if word of Brom's survival had reached the ears of Galbatorix's spies, you both would have had to flee Carvajal for fear of your lives. By keeping the truth hidden from you, Brom hoped to protect you from those dangers.
He didn't succeed. We had to flee Carvajal anyway.
Yes, said Aramis. Brom's mistake, as it were, although I judge it has yielded more good than ill, was that he could not bear to separate himself entirely from you. If he had had the strength to refrain from returning to Carvajal, you never would have found Saphira's egg, the Razak would not have killed your uncle, and many things that were not would have been, and many things that are would not be. He could not cut you out of his heart, though.
Aragorn clenched his jaw as a tremor coursed through him. And after he learned Saphira had hatched for me?
Aramis hesitated, and his calm expression became somewhat troubled. I am not sure, Aragorn. It may have been that Brom was still trying to protect you from his enemies, and he did not tell you for the same reason he did not bring you to the Varden straight away, because it would have been more than you were ready for. Perhaps he was planning to tell you just before you went to the Varden. If I had to guess, though, I would guess that Brom held his tongue not because he was ashamed of you, but because he had become accustomed to living with his secrets, and was loath to part with them. And because, and this is no more than speculation, because he was uncertain how you might react to his revelation. By your own account, you were not that well acquainted with Brom before you left Carvajal with him. It is quite possible he was afraid that you might hate him, if he told you he was your father.
Hate him? Exclaimed Aragorn. I wouldn't have hated him, although I might not have believed him.
And would you have trusted him after such a revelation? Aragorn bit the inside of his cheek.
No, I wouldn't have.
Continuing, Aramis said, Brom did the best he could in what were incredibly trying circumstances. Before all else, it was his responsibility to keep the two of you alive, and to teach and advise you, Aragorn, so that you would not use your power for selfish means as Galbatorix has done. In that, Brom acquitted himself with distinction. He may not have been the father you wished him to be, but he gave you as great an inheritance as any son has ever had.
It was no more than he would have done for whoever became the new rider.
That does not diminish its value, Aramis pointed out. But you are mistaken. Brom did more for you than he would have for anyone else. You need only think of how he sacrificed himself to save your life, to know the truth of that. With the nail of his right index finger, Aragorn picked at the edge of the table, following a faint ridge formed by one of the rings in the wood.
And it really was an accident that Arya sent Saphira to me.
It was, Aramis confirmed, but it was not entirely a coincidence. Instead of transporting the egg to the father, Arya made it appear before the son.
How could that be if she had no knowledge of me?
Aramis's thin shoulders rose and fell. Despite thousands of years of study, we still cannot predict or explain all of the effects of magic. Aragorn continued to finger the small ridge in the edge of the table.
I have a father, he thought. I watched him die, and I had no idea who he was to me.
My parents, he said.
Were they ever married?
I know why you ask, Aragorn, and I do not know if my answer will satisfy you. Marriage is not an elvish custom, and the subtleties of it often escape me. No one joined Brom's and Selina's hands in marriage, but I know that they considered themselves to be husband and wife. If you are wise, you will not worry that others of your race may call you a bastard, but rather be content to know that you are your parents' child, and that they both gave their lives that you might live.
It surprised Aragorn how calm he felt. His entire life he had speculated about the identity of his father. When Murtagh had claimed it was Morzan, the revelation had shocked Aragorn as deeply as had the death of Garrow. Gleyder's counterclaim that Aragorn's father was Brom had also shocked him, but the shock did not seem to have lasted, perhaps because this time the news was not as upsetting. Calm as he was, Aragorn thought that it might be many years before he was certain of his feelings toward either of his parents.
My father was a rider, and my mother was Morzan's consort and Black Hand.
Could I tell Nasawada? He asked.
Aramis spread his hands. Tell whomever you wish. The secret is now yours to do with as you please. I doubt you would be in any more danger if the whole world knew you were Brom's heir.
Murtagh, Aragorn said. He believes we are full brothers. He told me so in the ancient language.
And I am sure Galbatorix does as well.
It was the twins who figured out that Murtagh's mother and your mother were one and the same person,
and this they conveyed to the king. But they could not have informed him of Brom's involvement, for there was no one among the Varden who was privy to that information.
Aragorn glanced up as a pair of swallows swooped by overhead, and he allowed himself a wry half-smile.
Why do you smile? Aramis asked.
I'm not sure you would understand.
The elf folded his hands in his lap.
I might not. That is true. But then you cannot know for certain unless you try to explain.
It took Aragorn a while to find the words he needed.
When I was younger, before all of this,
he gestured at Sephira and Aramis and Gleyder and the world in general,
I used to amuse myself by imagining that because of her great wit and beauty, my mother had been taken in among the courts of Galbatorix's nobles. I imagined that she had travelled from city to city and supped with the earls and ladies in their halls, and that, well, she had fallen desperately in love with a rich and powerful man, but for some reason she was forced to hide me from him. So she gave me to Garrow and Marion for safekeeping. And one day she would return and tell me who I was, and that she had never wanted to leave me behind.
That is not so different from what happened, said Aramis.
No, it isn't, but I imagined that my mother and my father were people of importance, and I was someone of importance as well. Fate gave me what I wanted, but the truth of it is not as grand or as happy as I thought it would be. I was smiling at my own ignorance, I suppose, and also at the unlikeliness of everything that has befallen me.
A light breeze swept across the clearing, feathering the grass at their feet and stirring the branches of the forest around them. Aragorn watched the fluttering of the grass for a few moments, then slowly asked,
Was my mother a good person?
I could not say, Aragorn. The events of her life were complicated. It would be foolish and arrogant of me to presume to pass judgment on one I know so little of.
But I need to know.
Aragorn clasped his hands, pressing his fingers between the calluses on his knuckles.
When I asked Brom if he had known her, he said that she was proud and dignified, and that she always helped the poor and those less fortunate than her. How could she, though? How could she be that person and also the Black Hand?
Joad told me stories about some of the things, horrible, terrible things, she did while she was in Morzan's service.
Was she evil then? Did she not care if Galbatorix ruled or not? Why did she go with Morzan in the first place?
Aramis paused. Love can be a terrible curse, Aragon. It can make you overlook even the largest flaws in a person's behavior. I doubt that your mother was fully aware of Morzan's true nature when she left Carvajal with him. And once she had, he would not have allowed her to disobey his wishes. She became his slave in all but name, and it was only by changing her very identity that she was able to escape his control.
But Jode said that she enjoyed what she did as the Black Hand.
An expression of faint disdain altered Aramis's features. Accounts of past atrocities are often exaggerated and distorted. That much you should keep in mind. No one but your mother knows exactly what she did, nor why, nor how she felt about it, and she is not still among the living to explain herself.
Whom should I believe, though? Pleaded Aragon. Brom or Jode?
When you asked Brom about your mother, he told you what he thought were her most important qualities. My advice would be to trust in his knowledge of her. If that does not quell your doubts, remember that whatever crimes she may have committed while acting as the Hand of Morzan, ultimately your mother sided with the Varden, and went to extraordinary lengths to protect you. Knowing that, you should not torment yourself further about the nature of her character. Propelled by the breeze, a spider hanging from a gossamer strand of silk drifted past Aragon, rising and falling on the invisible eddies of air. When the spider had floated out of view, Aragon said,
"The first time we visited Trondheim, the fortune-teller Angela told me that it was Brom's weird to fail at everything he attempted, except for killing Morzan."
Aramis inclined his head. "One might think that. Another might conclude that Brom achieved many great and difficult things. It depends upon how you choose to view the world. The words of fortune-tellers are rarely easy to decipher. It has been my experience that their predictions are never conducive to peace of mind. If you wish to be happy, Aragon, think not of what is to come, nor of that which you have no control over, but rather of the now, and of that which you are able to change." A thought occurred to Aragon then.
"Blagden!" he said,
referring to the White Raven who was Queen Islanzade's companion.
"He knows about Brom as well, doesn't he?"
One of Aramis's sharp eyebrows lifted. "Does he? I never spoke of it to him. He is a fickle creature and not to be relied upon."
"The day Saphira and I left for the Burning Plains, he recited a riddle to me. I can't remember every line, but it was something about one of two being one, while one might be two. I think he might have been hinting that Murtagh and I only share a single parent."
"It is not impossible," said Aramis. "Blagden was here in Ellesmere when Brom told me about you. I would not be surprised if that sharp-beaked thief happened to be perched in a nearby tree during our conversation. Eavesdropping is an unfortunate habit of his. It might also be that his riddle was the result of one of his sporadic fits of foresight." A moment later, Gleda stirred, and Aramis turned and glanced back at the golden dragon. The elf rose from his chair with a graceful motion, saying, "Fruit, nuts, and bread are fine fare, but after your trip, you should have something more substantial to fill your belly. I have a soup that needs tending, simmering in my hut. But please, do not bestir yourself. I will bring it to you when it is ready." His footsteps soft upon the grass, Aramis walked to his bark-covered house and disappeared inside. As the carved door closed, Gleda huffed out his breath and closed his eyes, seeming to fall asleep. And all was silent, save the rustle of the wind-tossed branches. Inheritance. Aragon remained sitting at the round table for several minutes. Then he stood and walked to the edge of the crags of Telnair, where he gazed out over the rolling forest 1,000 feet below. With the tip of his left boot, he pushed a pebble over the cliff, and watched it bounce off the slanted face of the stone,
until it vanished into the depths of the canopy. A branch cracked as Saphira approached from behind. She crouched by his side, her scales painting him with hundreds